Our next case this morning is number 05-2158, the United States against Howard D. Phillips. Ms. Bruno.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Bruno and I represent the appellant Howard Phillips. We are asking the court to grant Mr. Phillips a new trial today because his first one was not fair. The government committed prosecutorial misconduct by revealing to the jury during closing argument that Mr. Phillips had a criminal history. This information was not in evidence, it was not admissible, but yet it was the second time the jury heard about it. The first time, Mr. Phillips' father blurted out during his testimony that his son had spent time in prison before, and at that time the judge instructed the jury to disregard the information. So the government's comment during closing argument was the second time the jury heard that Mr. Phillips was a criminal.
Well, I think that overstates it. Wasn't the father's testimony that he couldn't remember how long he had been friends with the accomplice because he had been locked up?
He'd been in prison.
And one inference, at least, from that was that that had to do with the present charge and not any prior criminal history?
Absolutely. That's a possible inference. But during closing argument, when counsel revealed that Mr. Phillips went to a probation office, any ambiguity was cleared up. It was clear at that point that he had a criminal history.
Well, wasn't there an objection made then to that misstatement at closing, and the statement was stricken, and the prosecutor then came back and said it was an employment office, not a probation office, which was untrue, but at least set the matter straight as far as the jury was concerned and as to the defendant's prior record?
Well, I don't believe the statement was stricken during closing argument. The statement was stricken.
There was an objection, and
there was an objection,
the prosecutor came back and said, never mind, I meant an employment office.
Absolutely. The prosecutor came back and said, I made a mistake. I meant employment office.
So what possible prejudice could have resulted?
Well, because there were now two instances where the jury heard at least suggestions that Mr. Phillips had a criminal history.
Suggestions, but not evidence.
That's correct.
And the jury is told to rely solely on the evidence. The jury is also instructed that the prosecutor's closing argument is not evidence, and if anything that the prosecutor says in closing conflicts with the evidence, they're to disregard.
Well, that's correct, but after so much suggestion about a person's criminal history, that a person had a criminal history, we can't be sure at this point that the jury was able to disregard that information.
We don't have to be sure. You need to show prejudice.
That's
correct.
And
what possible prejudice on this record could have obtained from those two very vague references, one of which was corrected?
Well, according to the Supreme Court, there are several factors to look at to assess prejudice, and one of those factors is the weight of the evidence. Had this been a very strong case, maybe we would be less concerned about...
This was an overwhelming case.
Well, I disagree, actually.
We've got an accomplice's testimony. We've got him caught on videotape. We've got his DNA at one of the scenes.
My client wasn't ever caught on videotape. The accomplice was caught on videotape, and the accomplice's testimony was the critical, crucial evidence against my client. And the accomplice's testimony was a nightmare. The accomplice's credibility was called into question many different ways. He had a long criminal history. He had lied to the police about the details of this case. He was addicted to crack cocaine, which he said affected his memory. He used crack cocaine while out on bond on this case. It almost cost his mother her house. Like I said, he lied to the police and changed his story about this case. For example, to the point where he made up facts of the case. I mean, he told the police that following the first bank robbery, he and my client went to a dope house, and in his words, and split the proceeds, and Mr. Creighton used crack cocaine. The dope house didn't even exist. That story was complete fiction.
I thought he was caught on, to go back to my prior understanding of the record, I thought your client was caught with the accomplice on videotape
buying
the the hat and the gloves and
absolutely.
The toy gun and all of that.
I'm sorry, I was thinking about the bank surveillance. He was never caught on the bank surveillance. No, that's correct. He was caught out shopping with the accomplice. He was caught out buying a hat and gloves in
the implements of the crime.
They ended up being the implements of the crime. That's correct. But the government had a lot of evidence, and all of this other evidence that was submitted over 4 days and that the government lined up and numbered in its brief all amounted to nothing without Kelvin Creighton's testimony. All of that other evidence shows that my client went shopping with the accomplice. He bought a hat and gloves in the middle of January. He bought a toy gun. He bought duct tape. And he was caught outside the bank smoking a cigarette. These are not guilty activities in and of themselves.
They provide physical corroboration of the accomplice's testimony.
Right. Only if you believe the accomplice's testimony.
No. And they buttress the accomplice's testimony.
They buttress a lot of
Make
innocent.
Make it more believable.
They buttress a lot of innocent details. That's correct. They buttress a lot of the innocent details of the accomplice's story.
Details buttress the accomplice's story. Or so the jury was entitled to believe, making this a very strong case rather than a very weak one.
Well, but I do want to return to the fact that you still need, in the end, to believe Kelvin Creighton for this to be a strong case. And Kelvin Creighton was... He was not a credible witness, and we know that the jury didn't find him to be a credible witness because the jury acquitted Mr. Phillips of the first offense. And for this offense, the government didn't have any extra evidence that the two men were together that day. The government didn't have any extra evidence that Mr. Phillips, my client, was ever in the vicinity of the bank. And so the jury acquitted. The jury acquitted because all they had was Kelvin Creighton's testimony, and that testimony was completely not credible. And so... All you have for the other three charges are these extra details, these details that the two men engaged in a lot of innocent activities together, but still we're left relying on Mr. Creighton's testimony to put all of those pieces together and turn Mr. Phillips's innocent activities of running errands, shopping, and hanging out with someone maybe he shouldn't have been hanging out with. We need Mr. Creighton's testimony to put all of that together and say, these were parts of the grand criminal scheme.
There was also testimony, wasn't there, that implicated him in a cover-up, essentially, of his tracks here. And I'm referring to the testimony of the aunt. Wasn't there an aunt who owned the getaway car? And after the two accomplices, including Mr. Phillips, crashed the car, he called her up and told her to report that it was stolen.
There was no evidence besides Mr. Creighton's testimony that Mr. Phillips was in the car for that car crash. A witness saw two men running from the scene.
But am I correct that we do have the aunt's testimony that he called and asked her to do that, or is that not correct?
We have the aunt's testimony that Kelvin Creighton called her that day. And that testimony was impeached.
Not that Phillips called her?
No, she testified that Mr. Creighton, the accomplice, called her that day. Mr. Creighton testified that he called that Mr. Phillips called the aunt.
Okay.
But Mr. Creighton had told the police two times earlier that he was the one who called the aunt. And the aunt testified that it was Mr. Creighton. So the only person we have testifying about that Phillips called the aunt was Mr. Creighton. Again,
but
back to his testimony.
But the call came from Phillips' phone?
There was evidence that the call came from a prepaid phone that the government presented some other evidence that was Mr. Phillips' phone.
And the aunt had previously stated to the police that it was Phillips.
The aunt,
but
that's right.
Later changed her mind and testified at trial that it was Creighton, and she was impeached with that prior statement.
Right. Well, she told the police two things in the past. She told the police both that it was her nephew who called, and
that was Phillips, right?
That's Phillips, and she also told the police that it was Mr. Creighton who called. At trial, she testified unequivocally that she remembered it was Mr. Creighton who called her. So I think it's important to remember that in the end, you really need to believe Mr. Creighton in order to put all the pieces together of this case. The government did not have strong evidence in any other sense except Mr. Creighton's testimony that Mr. Phillips was involved in these bank robberies. The government's evidence doesn't rule out the possibility that Mr. Creighton was manipulating Mr. Phillips. There are lots of stories that the government's additional evidence can tell. And the only person telling the story that Mr. Phillips was a knowing participant in these bank robberies was Mr. Creighton. I think I'm running into my rebuttal. So,
thank you, Ms. Bruno. We'll hear now from Ms. Blackwood.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Elizabeth Blackwood. I obviously was also the trial counsel that made the mistake at trial. I regret that mistake today, as I did 2 years ago. After spending 4 days in trial and calling, I think it was 37 witnesses, we bent over backwards to conceal the fact that the defendant was on parole for armed robbery, and that on the day of one of the bank robberies, he had gone with his accomplice to meet with his probation agent. We bent over backwards to conceal that information from the jury. On closing argument, I made what was an honest mistake, an easy mistake to make, because I was describing it as it was when we were trying to cover up that fact throughout the trial. I immediately realized I had made it. Counsel immediately objected, and we corrected it. It's an understatement to say that I was a bit embarrassed at the time, and I remain mortified today because I wish I hadn't done it. But the point is that my slip turned into an unexpected bonus, really, for the defendant in the case. We fixed the error by explaining that I had misspoken and that, in fact, it was an employment office that the defendant had visited that day. I repeated that on another occasion, and the defense, in his closing argument, jumped on that wagon and described it at one point as the employment office as well. So the implication was that the defendant, rather than being a loaf, necessarily, was actually looking for work, when in truth that was far from the truth. So in effect, my mistake was converted to a windfall for the defendant. I think it would be safe to say on this record, Your Honors, that if I hadn't made that solitary mistake, the defendant would have experienced what I would call a perfect trial. But the test, as we know, is not whether or not the defendant had a perfect trial. It's whether or not he had a fair trial. The defendant's trial in this case was fair, and it was one step away from perfect. And I will just briefly discuss the second ground that counsel has alleged in the brief for error. That error was not error at all. That was a witness that was called by the government simply to establish that the telephone that was used to call the defendant's aunt to tell her to report the car stolen, the father was called because that phone called the father on several occasions. And so that was the government's only purpose in calling him. And for whatever reason, he blurted out in an answer that was wholly unresponsive to my question that he doesn't know who the defendant's friends are because the defendant's been, I think, locked up for so long. There was a sidebar. The court gave an immediate curative instruction that was a little bit vague, but almost implied that maybe he was talking about the friend. But at cross-examination, the defense counsel chose to rectify the matter in another way that was favorable to the defendant by leading the jury to believe that the father was referring to the amount of time that the defendant had been incarcerated since the offense. And, of course, that wasn't prejudicial at all because, as we know, the defendant, for whatever reason, chose to appear at trial in his jail uniform. I raised that in the very beginning. Why is the defendant in his jail uniform? And it was placed on the record that clothes had been brought for him, but he chose not to wear them. He wanted to be honest to the jury. So there was no error, no prejudice on that ground. Suffice it to say that the defendant received a very fair trial. The evidence in the case was surely overwhelming, and I ask that the court affirm the conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time did Ms. Bruno have? You have a minute, Ms. Bruno.
I just want to clear up any confusion. Our brief alleges one ground for error, and one ground for error, and the only ground is the district court's refusal to grant a mistrial at the end of closing argument. The ground counsel was talking about was the motion for a mistrial at the end of Phillips's father's testimony, and that motion was denied. We think that Phillips's father's testimony is important only because it set the stage for the jury to have the suggestion in its mind that Mr. Phillips had a criminal history. And the reason that's important is because that makes it far less likely that the jury believed the government's suggestion that it was just a mere slip of the tongue to say that Mr. Phillips visited a probation office. So I don't think it's fair to say that the defendant received an unexpected bonus, or I don't think it's fair to assume that the jury believed the government's correction, which was untrue. I think we should believe that the jury was able to sort out what was true from what was false in that regard, and not believe that Mr. Phillips actually visited an employment office. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bruno. Ms. Bruno, you served by appointment of the court in this case, and you have the sincere thanks of the court for your very effective efforts on behalf of your client. Thank you for taking the case. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement. The court has finished the call of the morning, and therefore we will rise until the next scheduled oral argument, which is this afternoon.